Glenn Campbell. Join me and our own Pat Paulson and our guests here on the Glenn Campbell Good Time Hour. It's going to be a great show.
Maybe not great, but mildly entertaining.
Oh, yeah? I'm going to love you.
The Monkees join Glenn tonight on CBS. This week on the CBS Thursday Night Movies.
Please, don't eat the baby.
It's fun on the family plan when Doris Day and David Niven share a slap-happy marriage complete with comical kids, affectionate dogs, scheming other women, and lots of laughs in the captivating comedy about love, marriage, mischief, and mayhem. Please don't eat the daisies. And on Friday night, this is Penelope. And this is Penelope. And this. And this. What is there about her that has psychiatrist Dick Shawn baffled? Detective Peter Falk puzzled. And Professor Jonathan Winters wild with curiosity. Find out when Natalie Wood stars as the world's loveliest bank robber in the world's most hilarious heist. She's public entertainment number one, Penelope. WCBS-TV, Channel 2. Black Heritage, a history of Afro-Americans. Our current topic, black radicals and abolitionists. Today's subject, freedom cry in the 50s. With Dr. Vincent Harding. Dr. Harding is chairman of the history and sociology departments of Spelman College and the director of the Martin Luther King Library Project in Atlanta, Georgia. Dr. Benjamin Qualls, professor of history, Morgan State College, Baltimore, Maryland. Dr. Qualls, a recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship, is also the author of 6 books on Afro-American history. His most recent book is Black Abolitionists. And Sterling Stuckey. Mr. Stuckey is an instructor of history at Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois. And now, Dr. Harding.
As we've tried to look at the Northern scene in which many, many black people were involved, we've begun to explore that movement that we call abolitionism. And of course, by abolitionism, we mean the organized struggle against slavery in America. It's terribly important, I imagine, to say again that abolitionism was a struggle against what we must say was a part of the American way of life, that slavery was locked into the American society legally, economically, judicially, and in some ways culturally and spiritually. America simply seemed for much of the 19th century to accept slavery as a part of its way of life, and those who struggled against it in organized and unorganized forms, those who we call black abolitionists, those who we call abolitionists at large, were really going against what was defined at that time as a part of America and as a part of the way in which America saw itself. We've talked about the ways in which black people played a significant role in the struggle against slavery. And we've talked about the ways in which it is so important to realize that again and again, throughout our history, blacks have played a significant part, very often the most important part, in their own movement toward liberation. But the fact often is that we have not been able to see that in the books that have been written. But now we want to move on in our discussion of the black abolitionist movement to raise some questions about things that have to do with the relationships between the blacks and the whites who were a part of the abolitionist struggle. I remember seeing in a recent newspaper article, or perhaps it was a journal, a comment about the way in which black and white soldiers said that it was one thing for them to be melded together in the heat of battle and to have to depend upon one another, but after the battles were over, some of the same separations were there back at the base or in the town. And that, in a sense, reminds me a great deal of this struggle that blacks and whites participated in the abolitionist movement. And Dr. Quarles, out of your own writings and researches on black abolitionists, and particularly on the book that you've just published, I wonder if you might reflect a bit on what were the nature of some of the relationships between black and white abolitionists. Let's take a person like Frederick Douglass, who in many ways symbolizes the primary voice in black abolitionism in the 19th century. If we take a man like Douglass, what do we learn about Frederick Douglass's own relationship to white abolitionists, for instance?
The abolitionist movement was what we would call today an integrated movement. The black abolitionists joined with white abolitionists. Although there were some predominantly black societies, it was basically an integrated movement. But in this movement, the whites assumed leadership, and they sometimes assumed that the Negro was not ready to be a leader, and that he should therefore be dependent upon them for advice and for counsel and for guidance. And this is particularly true of Frederick Douglass, who had been befriended by the white abolitionists after his escape from slavery, and they tended to think of him always as an escaped slave rather than as a maturing individual. Hence, after 5 or 6 years of exposure with the white abolitionists, Douglass prepared to move on his own. He wanted to have a newspaper of his own. He wanted to make his own decisions in the abolitionist movement. And while the white abolitionists, fine as they were thoroughly against slavery, the acceptance of a former slave as an equal in the movement, they were not quite ready for that step. And hence, Garrison and Douglass, although they had been fast friends for 6 years, they split in 1847 and were never reconciled.
I think Douglass put it very well himself when he recounted a dialogue which took place between himself and white abolitionists, and they said, "Give us the facts, Fred, and we'll take care of the rest. Just stand up there and tell us what slavery was like. We'll do the leading."
What about other kinds of relationships between black and white abolitionists? Were there other kinds of tensions that were there in this movement?
I think so. For example, when Henry Harlan Garnett in the early 40s, 1840s, spoke out sharply against slavery and actually urged the slaves, an address to the slaves, Lydia Maria Child and Mary Chapman Weston, two white abolitionists, thought that he had gone too far and reprimanded him, and he in turn refuted that reprimand, said he could speak for himself. So sometimes the white abolitionists presumed to tell a Negro abolitionist what they thought of his procedure or his point of view. And this, of course, tended to alienate some black abolitionists and make them feel. Now, when the abolitionists split, as they did in 1840, two different wings of the white abolitionists, this meant increasingly that the Negro would have to look to his own resources, the resources of
the black community. Let's come back to that in a minute, but I'd like to explore some more the whole matter of the social relationships, for instance, between black and white abolitionists. As I recall, one of the major complaints that many black persons made against their abolitionist colleagues was that there were many of them who were quite ready to stand on the same platform with blacks and to protest against slavery, but that when the meetings were over, that blacks went one way and whites the other, and that as a matter of fact, it seems to me that a very strong complaint was made against many of the white abolitionists who were in business, that they themselves would not hire black people on any level other than the menial level. So it seems to me that there were a number of these kinds of tensions there, as evidently many white abolitionists saw the struggle against slavery as not quite the same as the struggle for true equality and freedom for black people.
That would be, of course, correct. They did focus their attention on the struggle against slavery, the strike at slavery. Now, the concomitant striking at discrimination against the free Negro, their heart was not in that nearly to the extent that it was in striking at slavery. Hence, matters of the economic advancement of the free black in the North or the social advancement or even the educational advancement were not nearly as dear to their heart as striking against slavery in the South.
Speaking of striking, that's strikingly similar, it seems to me, to situations which blacks in the movement today face. White liberals in northern suburbs are quite willing to send checks to them, but are very often not willing, hardly ever willing, to live in the same neighborhoods with black people. And furthermore, it seems that one of the critical points of conflict between the abolitionists and white and black abolitionists was that white abolitionists objected to black abolitionists having the Negro Convention movement, feeling that they didn't need to meet in separate quarters to decide what should be done about their situation. Of course, blacks objected to this quite stringently.
You made reference earlier, Dr. Flores, to a split that came between and among the white abolitionists particularly, and the relationship that this then had to the role of black people in the abolitionist movement. Would you say some more about that at this point?
Yes, in 1840, the abolitionists, who had had one national society, the American Anti-Slavery Society, are split, and one group then was headed by Garrison, which retained the name American Anti-Slavery Society, with its greatest strength in Massachusetts, with an outpost or two in Ohio. And then the New York School of Abolitionists, the American Foreign Anti-Slavery Society, founded in 1840, immediately after the split. So there were two groups of abolitionists, and naturally they would spend some time attacking each other. Now this brought to the black community the fact that they would increasingly have to turn to their own resources, to the black community, to muster strength against slavery, as if the strength that was lost in the split of the two great abolitionist groups in 1840.
So you've called this in your book, as I recall, a new emphasis on black self-help and turning towards the resources of the black community, but also I imagine this is an emphasis on the condition of black people in the North that the whites had not taken up in their understanding of abolitionism as well.
Yes, precisely.
What kinds of examples of this sort of self-help emphasis would you give to help us to understand the way in which black people were moving at this point?
Well, the strike at slavery, they thought, to prove that the free Negro could bear the responsibilities of freedom, and therefore they thought of self-help and cultural improvement as a blow against slavery. And this is why they placed so much emphasis on this. In addition to the American ideal of bettering oneself, they had a double motive, to strike at slavery. And hence they formed these mutual aid societies to help each other in sickness and in sorrow and in various trials, giving pennies a week and so much per month. They formed a number of these societies throughout the North. These are self-help societies in the absence of any social welfare of any kind. So these were quite numerous in the black community, a characteristic of the black community, self-help, to show one's own independence.
So what you say then is that what we usually understand as being simply very often a kind of conservative development within the black community was really understood by many black people as part of their struggle against slavery, because they were proving that they were indeed ready to live as free people on their own.
Yes, every black abolitionist was also a leader in these movements for self-help and cultural improvement, because they saw this as the other side of the coin in contradistinction from the whites, who didn't quite see it that clearly. So therefore, when the Negroes had these cultural to debate and to discuss and to talk about topics of the day, aesthetic topics as well as economic and political topics, there were a great number of these lyceums and movements for self-improvement in addition to mutual help. This characterized the Negro community, and one of the authorities, Mrs. Porter, Dorothy Porter, has traced the existence of 35 of these cultural improvement organizations among blacks in the North in the antebellum period. And there were many more about whom the record doesn't reveal them fully.
Very interesting. Now, what about the black press? Would this also be part of your understanding of the self-help direction?
Yes, there can be no question about that. The black press was geared to fight. The very first one was called Freedom's Journal.
Right, we talked about that last time.
Douglas's North Star, the North Star beckoning one to freedom. The very title of their paper, The Weekly Advocate. All of their papers bore a name which indicated an emphasis on freedom. So that the black newspapers, of which there were 17, of which we have a record, many of them have extant copies, which the libraries have. showing their fight through the media of journalism. And this was bearing testimony against slavery and also calling attention to these mutual aid societies and self-improvement groups that we've mentioned. Mm-hmm. We know a great deal from the black press about the activities mm-hmm. of these abolitionists.
Sterling, were you going to say something about the whole self-help emphasis and its role in the abolitionist struggle?
Yes, I was thinking that these self-help organizations have had a long tradition extending at least back into the last quarter of the 18th century, but it seems to me that one of the major reasons for the intensification, proliferation of these groups was precisely the inability of blacks to be able to play roles of leadership in the abolitionist movement, and they afforded self-help organizations among blacks, afforded them an opportunity to develop their own leadership, their own confidence, and a sense of solidarity, of racial solidarity, which they felt, certainly in the main, were all essential to their being free people in this country.
When we think about black solidarity and self-help organizations, obviously one of our major thoughts goes immediately to the black churches. Do they play a significant role in the abolitionist movement as well, Dr. Quarles?
Yes, highly significant. They play it in part because the leadership of the churches was generally an educated leadership, and that was the leadership in the black abolitionist movement. The clergymen were natural leaders. They depended upon the black community for support, hence they could speak for the black community without fear of reprisals of one kind or another. In fact, the eight Negroes who joined the American and Foreign Anti-Slavery Society in 1840 after the split, all eight of these charter members were clergymen, so that the black clergy, they used their churches for the Underground Railroad, for anti-slavery meetings. The black church was geared into the abolitionist crusade.
This is a very interesting point. As you know, this is something that I'm very concerned about, and that is that many of our younger black people have taken a definition of religion that basically comes out of the white Western society, meaning very often that which is apart from active political life. And they have accused the black churches of really doing this same kind of escaping from life. But it seems to me that we can see both in the North and in the South that the black church certainly plays a very, very different role. The white abolitionists, by and large, evidently had to move away from their churches in order to be effective in their role as abolitionists, whereas, on the other hand, the black abolitionists had their church around them, in a sense, as support in their struggle against slavery.
Many of them had to move out of those very white churches in order to be effective.
To say nothing of that. And isn't it fascinating that this is, of course, part of what is going on today as well, a whole new understanding of the role of this black solidarity within the church to carry on the struggle for the unfinished freedom that the black people still move towards.
May I just add one point? I think the most militant Negro, the most definitely outspoken Negro of the antebellum period was probably Henry Harlan Garnett, who was a Presbyterian clergyman.
Yeah.
And therefore, here is a man preaching the church militant,
right,
as well as the church social.
Right. Right. Of course, David Walker, who is not a minister as such, but certainly a religious person in the sense of being an advocate of black religion, mm-hmm, was extremely militant.
I think we can see this stream going throughout the whole situation. Now, one thing we haven't talked about yet that I think has some real significance, and that is the way in which black abolitionists felt that their plea was not sufficient if it was made only to the American society. We've talked a lot in the struggle today about the internationalizing of the struggle. I gather from what I've read of your own work and elsewhere that the black abolitionists of the 19th century felt that they too had to move beyond the American society in making their voices heard. Would you say some more about that?
Well, yes, there was an Anglo-American concert against slavery where British abolitionists and American abolitionists joined forces against slavery. Now, slavery was done away with in the British Isles itself in 1833. But 5 years afterward, the British formed an anti-slavery society to aid the struggle in America. And therefore, after 1839, we get a stream of Negroes going to the British Isles, where they were generally very well received, where they would plead the cause, raise funds for the cause, and keep British public opinion attuned to the evils of slavery in the United States, so that they performed a notable service there in sensitizing British opinion against the evils of slavery, so that there was a long parade of them.
That perspective from abroad surely must have convinced many of them that America was not at all a place of innocence, as many Americans at home were saying, while Europe being the center of decadence.
Yes.
Well, not only that, but I think two other things would need to be said. One, the role of blacks going to England, sensitizing England against slavery, was certainly well remembered when the Civil War came and when the Union needed British support in many ways, because it seems to me that a great deal of that British support during the Civil War can be traced back to the fact that blacks had gone to plead the cause against slavery. But I imagine we'd also have to say that probably many of the blacks who went came back rather confused, too, because it's very clear that that it was much easier for England to wrap their arms literally and figuratively around black men, since there were so few there, and to send black men back to America, sometimes thinking that there really was a white country in the world where everything was fine as far as black people were concerned. Of course, we were to learn different things as the 20th century came about, but I'm sure, and I remember some real tension as black people tried to understand the real nature of their experience there on the English Isles.
May I add one thing to your very suggestive remarks on the world view that the blacks took, looking beyond the bounds of American society? It seems to me that when one looks within American society at this particular time, one finds certain black abolitionists, at least, visioning some sort of relationship between themselves, between black people in this country, and the despised Indians from whom the country had been taken. Delaney, I think, illustrates this most eloquently in his novel, Blake, where he has a dialogue with an Indian chief, and the Indian chief says to him toward the end, a lot of black people I don't like, but those blacks down in Florida I like heat much, because they understand that if you want the white man to love you, you've got to fight him. Interesting.
Okay, let me go back to this whole matter of the black abolitionists' understanding of the struggle that they were involved in. Evidently, like our own experience in the 20th century, many black abolitionists eventually turned more and more towards political action, towards the feeling that it was only as they depended upon the political process more and more that that they would find the help that they needed. And I imagine that one of the things this meant was that they put more and more trust in white political leaders of some kinds. Now, as you think of that sort of development, which among the white political leaders of the time, what would you think of as being perhaps most idolized among the black people during that antebellum period, Dr. Florence?
You're quite right. The Negroes thought, in terms of political action, they were Americans. They believed the democratic way of life and participating. So they did look to politics. And in answer to your specific question, I would say Charles Sumner, who was a senator from Massachusetts, was certainly perhaps the most revered of all of the political figures that Negroes met. When he was out of the Senate for 6 years, when he came back in 1860, Negroes throughout the country hailed as he'd been out of the Senate 6 years ill after a fracas in the Congress of the United States. So Charles Sumner, who had fought for equality of school opportunity for Negroes, and won a notable case in 1855, a case that went to the Supreme Court, in which the schools in Boston, Massachusetts, of all things, were open to all people. Sumner was one of those, with a Negro counsel, Robert Morris, as his associate. He fought this case to the Supreme Court. And he always spoke out sharply against slavery in Congress. So that there's no other figure, I would say it was Charles Sumner.
In addition to this kind of seeking for help from white political figures like a Sumner, for instance, what else would you say would express this black emphasis on politics among the abolitionists during this period?
I think they were very receptive to the new political party, the Liberty Party, its very name,
right.
Then the Free Soil Party of 1848, and then even the Republican Party. Gradually, these parties dilute their abolitionist sentiment,
right.
But nevertheless, they are against the extension of slavery, and Negroes were attracted to these parties and attempted to give them support.
Right.
So that the extent to which they could vote in the North, and this was not a great extent,
yeah.
Even in New York State, they had to have, Negro had to have $250 worth of real estate before he could vote. But to the extent that they could vote, they made it a point to express themselves in politics, realizing this was a legitimate American expression in an area that they believed in very strongly.
And that they might be able to affect the destinies of black people in the South.
Yes, these are anti-slavery,
right.
Notably anti-slavery extension parties, but you're quite right. This was envisioned by them as a blow against slavery in the political arm.
Sure, and of course their whole participation in the petition movement, the hundreds and thousands of petitions that black people sent into Congress during these years would be another indication of their trust in the political process. But of course we've got to recognize the fact that when the 1850s came, with the Compromise of 1850 and that stringent fugitive slave law, when Kansas, Nebraska came, and especially when the Dred Scott decision came, many black people turned away from a political answer and a dependence upon white politics in America. Now, of course, one of the persons who turned most sharply away from this and turned to another kind of answer was Martin Delaney. And Sterling, I know that you've done some work on Martin Delaney. It seems to me that perhaps you could tell us something about this turn that Delaney made towards a whole new sort of answer for black people.
Yes. I would make one slight distinction, Vince. On certain questions, he certainly was quite constant. He was a man who was exceedingly proud of his blackness. He once remarked that when he died and went over to the other side, his great request would be that he be as black there as he was in life, so that he had the sense of integrity of blackness all along.
So it wasn't quite a turn.
Right.
Right. Well,
it certainly
okay.
wasn't. But as the decade of the 1850s moved along, as the years of the 1850s moved along, certainly he became all the more convinced that there was no solution to the race problem in America short of blacks leaving America's shores. He did not enjoy the support of most black people on this, but he certainly felt that immigration was a better answer, the establishment of a black state elsewhere than remaining in the United States of America.
Right. Well, this certainly is a way of looking at the most representative person of this whole black immigration surge. And we must say that during this period, many of the black abolitionists came to feel that this was the only way. But of course, we also have to say that this was a period when many people were looking to many ways, right. Because it was a period of almost franticness in the black community. When, for instance, the nation says that they have no rights that whites need to respect, people kept asking, what shall we do? And of course, one of the answers to what shall we do was found by those, for instance, who took up arms, whether it was in the black militia companies or whether it was elsewhere. For instance, one of the answers was found by those who felt that John Brown had the answer. And John Brown had with him a number of black companions, among them men like Dangerfield Newby, men like Leary, men like Anderson. These were some of those who felt that they had to find another way, and this was the answer in their own mind. And I imagine that we would have to say, too, that for many black abolitionists, that whole matter of armed struggle finally became the answer that the Civil War brought to them. Would you think that the Civil War, Dr. Qualls, was a kind of an ultimate answer for black people?
Well, I think it was the ultimate answer for slavery.
For slavery, right.
Yes,
right.
And even some of the white abolitionists who had been notorious pacifists came to believe in the late 50s that slavery had become such a part of the power structure that you could not overcome it any other way than by a direct confrontation.
Okay, so I imagine that's why we find a person like Martin Delaney, after having once turned towards Africa, then he comes back to be a part of the whole Civil War struggle, becoming a major in the Civil War. But black abolitionism went through those kinds of struggles, and it was because of all of those kinds of struggles that black people were able to share in the struggle for their own freedom.
Black Heritage, a history of Afro-Americans, presented in association with Columbia University. Our current topic, Black Radicals and Abolitionists. Our subject today was Freedom Cry in the 50s, with Dr. Vincent Harding, Chairman of the History and Sociology Departments of Spelman College, Atlanta, Georgia. Dr. Benjamin Qualls, Professor of History, Morgan State College, Baltimore, Maryland. And Sterling Stuckey. Mr. Stuckey is an instructor of history at Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois.
Got up before the others and ran naked across the plank floor into the front room to see Grandmama sewing a new button on my last year rag doll.
Bingo.
This is beautiful. It's right to the point, and it shows that not all black poetry is angry. It shows that it can touch the emotions.
I think it's a terribly angry poem. I think that's a terribly angry poem.
Anytime there's poverty, there's anger. But at the same time, there is some beauty in this. In the poverty, the grandmama was trying to do something to make Christmas morning happy for this young girl. Of course, there's anger, there's poverty, and there's frustration. But at the same time, there's beauty, because this says that regardless of the circumstances of the black family, there's someone there who cares and tries within whatever resources he or she has to do something.
But look what the culture allows, and look what it permits.
Oh, I agree that that's wrong.
And look at the picture. Here we have one little girl running across, naked across wooden planks, and what she sees on Christmas Day is her mother sewing a new button on last year's doll. I don't perceive that, certainly I do, as a work of art, as a lovely poem, but certainly I also see, on the other hand, a terrible anger that's ready to explode. You know, it hasn't exploded yet.
I think the ready to explode is the extension of your feelings. Or the extension of...
When they shared one common experience, which was poverty, a historical path weighted by the hand of oppression, they also shared a dream. To break free of the chains that fettered their souls and the souls of all black people living in the Western world. Inspired by the writings of W.E.B. Du Bois, the activities of the Garvey movement, the debates of the Pan-African Congress, the sweat, the pain, the blood, and dreams of black folk, the poets of the Harlem Renaissance enunciated the life beat of Negroes living in the first quarter of the 20th century in the United States. Their poetry expressed a new social posture, a new self-image, a new attitude toward the experience of segregation, discrimination, and bold-faced racism. Believing in the American dream and the American ideals, yet experiencing the shadows of 1619, which had turned into lynch ropes and Jim Crow laws. These young poets and the people of their world began to confront the lie that rolled their backs, branding them unworthy. They did not believe themselves unworthy, and so they wrote to assert their dignity and to affirm their right to enjoy their due respect as members in the Brotherhood of Man. Oh, believing in the goodwill of the dominant society, much of their poetry was addressed to the good conscience of white folk, interpreting and contesting the haze of social confusion which had masked and marred the humanity and dignity of black people. Much of their poetry expressed the complexity of emotions, feelings of dispossession, oppression, persecution, and rejection. My soul would sing a forgotten jungle song, and I would go back to darkness and to peace. But the great Western world holds me in fee, and I may never hope for full release, while to its alien gods I bend my knee. Something in me is lost, forever lost. Some vital thing has gone out of my heart, and I must walk the way of life a ghost among the sons of earth, a thing apart. For I was born far from my native clime, under the white man's menace, out of time. That was Claude McKay. Langston Hughes, he wrote to celebrate the black heritage of Africa and America. Black as the gentle night. Black as the kind and quiet night. Black as the deep productive earth, body out of Africa. The National Black Theater will present an anthology of 8 great poets of the Harlem Renaissance.
I was a red man one time, but the white men came. I was a black man too, but the white men came. They drove me out of the forest. They took me out of the jungle. I lost my tree. I lost my silver moon. Now they've caged me in the circus of civilization. Now I herd with the many, caged in the circus of civilization.
A million bees, bees passing in and out the moon, bees escaping out the moon, bees returning through the moon, silver bees intently buzzing, silver honey dripping from the swarm of bees. Earth is a waxen cell of the world comb, and I, a drone, lying on my back, lipping honey, getting drunk with silver honey. Wish that I might fly out past the moon and curl forever in some far-off farmyard flower. Tom-toms of the jungles beat in my blood, and all the wild hot moons of the jungle shine in my soul. I'm afraid of this civilization, so hard, so strong, so cold.
Black as the gentle night.
Enough to work the rolls. They run the commissary. They keep the books.
Yes, sir.
We gotta be grateful for being cheated.
Yes, sir.
Whippersnapper clerks call us out our names. We got to say, Mr. the Spending Boys.
Yes,
sir. They make our figures turn somersaults, and we buck in the middle and say, thank you, sir.
They don't come by once.
They got the judges, they got the lawyers, they got the jury rooms, they got the law. They got the manhood, they got the courage.
They don't come by.
They got the shotgun, they got the deputies.
They don't come by.
We get the justice in the end.
They come by 10.
They fist they clothes, they eyes look straight.
They don't come by one.
Our hands must open, our eyes must fall.
They don't come by 2.
They got the manhood, they got the courage. We slink around like hangtail hounds.
They burn us when we're dogs, and they burn us when we're men.
But they come by tens.
I had a buddy, 6 foot a man, muscles a perfect game to the heart, outworked, outfought any man or two men. Spoke out of turn at the commissary one day. They gave him a day to get out of the county. He didn't take it. He said, come get me.
Yes.
He stayed in the county. He lies there dead.
They don't come by one. They don't come by two.
Rain.
But they come by ten.
Down upon the sunny river.
They come by ten. The lazy laughing south with blood on its mouth. The sunny face south, be strong, idiot brain. Child mind itself. Scratching in the dead fire's ashes for a black man's bones. Cotton. Warm.
The magnolia scented south, beautiful like a woman, seductive as a dark-eyed whore, passionate, cruel, honey-lipped, syphilitic. That is the south.
And I, who am black, would love her.
But she spits in your face.
And I, who am black, would give her many rare gifts.
But she turns her back on you.
So now I speak to her. Cold, they call. For she, they say, is a kind of mistress. And in her house, my children may escape the spell of the south.
I'm leaving, I'm going up north, north and down, I'm going up north, north and down. America's walls, with not a shred of terror, malice, not a word of jeer. Darkly I gaze into the days ahead and see her might and granite wonders there. Beneath the touch of time's unerring hand, like priceless treasures, sinking in the sand. And I, whose magic could explore ways that others might not guess or see, am barred behind a door that has no open sesame. Kick on the cat!
Stand right steady. You're walking like Samson. Stand right steady. A big old lion. Stand right steady. He's toting his talking. Stand right steady. You're looking for Jimbo. Don't say nothing. Go ahead, Jimbo. Don't say nothing. Run in the bushes. Don't say nothing. The captain can't find you. Don't say nothing. The hound dog's gone. Oh, have mercy. Stop the running. Oh, have mercy. They can't find you. Oh, have mercy. Boy, you must be flying. Oh, have mercy. Good old Jimbo. Lord, Lord. One good day, when I get the drop, I'm going that same good way that Jimbo gone. Good old Jimbo, Lord, Lord. He done gone. He done gone. Lord, Lord.
Little black boy chased down the street. Nigger, nigger, never die. Black face and shiny eye. Nigger, nigger, nigger. Hannibal, Hannibal banging through the Alps. Let the proud Romans ran off with their scalps. Nigger, nigger, nigger. Toussaint, may the French flee, fought like a demon, set his people free. Nigger, nigger, nigger. Nigger, nigger, never die. Black face and shiny eye. Nigger, nigger.
If we must die, let it not be like hogs.